He couldn't sleep that night. He paced restlessly, drinking pots of coffee and cursing the sluggishness of time. He had to get hold of the dog. He had to. And soon, he had to cure it. But how? His throat moved. There had to be a way. Even with how little he knew, there must be a way.
Welcome back to Literary Guys. This is author Zachary Kellyan.
And this is Dr. Gordon McCallum.
You know, Gordon, last week we were dealing with an apocalyptic-level pandemic where the media and isolation had fomented fear and where murder was preferable to hope. We're also reading I Am Legend by Robert Matheson.
This is true. We got into some really dark stuff last week.
It is interesting some of the parallels that we can kind of see from this 1950s novel and some of the issues that we're dealing with today.
So we're going to focus this episode, well, at least part of it, on this dog story.
Doggos.
Because you know I love doggos, and I love the puppers. And by the way, if you have never looked in Urban Dictionary, that doggo is defined as a grown-up larger pupper, and a pupper is defined as a small doggo. So, thanks, Internet.
These are, of course, club terms.
No, they're not. Okay. There's different terms for that, but we'll talk about that not on the podcast.
Yeah, I love the dog bit, and I hate the dog bit because it is so tragic. But one of the things that I think this novel does time and time again so well is really find the pathos in these moments of extreme isolation, of literally being the last human being on Earth. And we kind of just see this dog, even the, if you want to call it, courtship of this dog, almost break Robert Neville. I mean, he starts praying again because he's like, maybe there's a God who at least cares about animals still. He's just so concerned for this dog, and the lengths he goes to kind of coax this dog into his life for some form of companionship is both relatable and heartbreaking.
So I think there's something that is very deep inside of us, which is the need to fill a hole. Like, it's this idea of...
Non-sexually.
I knew you were going to take it there. In all seriousness, yes. I feel like we as humans, this isn't just about men or masculinity, I think this is about humans, that when there is a hole in our lives, when there is a gap, when there is something not there, we fill it with something. Mm-hmm. And I love dogs. I think that, you know, if I could, I would have a dog. This doesn't make sense. But when I run into a doggo on the street, I want to go up. I want to pet that dog. I want to hang out with that dog.
As any sane person would and should.
Exactly. Like, it's all about the doggo. But I don't think that's what's going on here. Like, he is looking for companionship. Here's someone who has talked repeatedly about the lack of female companionship in his life. And
he starts comparing his existence to a monk-like existence.
He does,
after 3 years, he doesn't even really care about sex anymore. He just wants something.
Mm-hmm. So the thing with the dog is very innocent in many ways. And it's so basic. But I also sense that the thing that Richard Matheson is trying to get us to latch on to here is that the crushing world outside of him, this vampiric existence, which has taken away any sense of normalcy in life, the companionship that he is missing from friends other than Ben Cortman, who is not really a friend, he is an entity at this point, that this dog offers salvation to him. But it's salvation in trying to find a inadequate thing to fill a gap, a hole in his life.
Yeah, and I think there's also something there of meeting a fellow survivor. I think he kind of was at a point when the dog comes around where he's not suicidal. In fact, he questions why he isn't suicidal.
Exactly.
But he's certainly doesn't really feel like there's any point to his survival. He just keeps feeling the need to survive. And I think seeing this dog and imagining what this dog must have gone through to get this far through this pandemic, I think really kind of gives him a false sense of hope.
Well, the false sense of hope is both the false sense of companionship that he has, but also, quite tragically, that this is a very short-lived encounter with this dog. He does go through this, as you called it, a courtship to bring the dog in, but quickly realizes that despite his own better wishes, that this is not something which is tenable. And instead of dragging this out like any Hollywood movie would, I'm going to cut right to the conclusion of the dog story. The dog looked up at him with its dulled, sick eyes, and then its tongue faltered out and licked roughly and moistly across the palm of Neville's hand. Something broke in Neville's throat. He sat there silently while tears ran slowly down his cheeks. In a week, the dog was dead.
We are currently drinking beer for this episode. It's from a local brewery, Elysian. It's their Halloween fall-themed beer, Night Owl Pumpkin Ale. I would suggest we just raise our glasses and a toast to the dog.
To the nameless dog.
Yeah, it is interesting, you know, with all the death of arguably sentient vampires that we experience, with the tragedy of Neville reliving the memories of his wife who was taken by the same plague and who he tried to cling on to in those last moments. The really impactful part of this novel for me has always been the dog. And I've noticed that in a lot of movies, you know, we're kind of numb to violence against humans in movies. But if there's violence against an animal, it kind of hits home a little deeper. And I don't know what that says about humanity, but it certainly is effective in this novel.
I think in so many stories that are told in movies and whatnot, that the dog is an unwitting victim. Mm-hmm. Like, it is helpless, it is unable to do anything. And yet here what we see is a fighter. We see this dog who, against all odds, is still, yeah, like, hanging on to some shred of pseudo-vampiric or pre-vampiric life. And that's something that Robert Neville can relate to. Mm-hmm. The dog didn't do anything to cause this. I think what's interesting in this story is humanity didn't really do anything to cause this either. Like, yeah, we talked in the first episode about if this was about man versus self or man versus society or what this was. Like, it's very unclear. It's man versus nature, maybe. If this vampiric strain somehow just mutated about and came into our being or into our environment.
Yeah, and I think the brilliance of Richard Matheson is at play here, too, because, you know, it is such a bleak novel. And I think he waits a very long time to introduce the dog in the last half of the novel. And I think that that's a really brilliant move on his part because it harkens back to a time of innocence. Like you said, dogs are so pure. Mm-hmm. They're so genuine in their love and their affection. And this is a world that Neville is now living in that has no room for that at all. Mm-hmm. And I think the dog actually causes him to let his guard down a little. Because what happens right after the dog scenario is he meets a quote-unquote human survivor of this plague. Mm-hmm. And while his cockles are still raised a little bit, is it cockle? Cackles.
Cockles of his heart?
Cackles of a dog raises its cackles.
Oh, I don't know.
Definitely not cockles. That is cockles of the heart. I think it's cackles. Dogs raise their cackles. Robert Neville's cackles were up about this.
So can we discuss this more on our etymology podcast, which is called Cockles or Cackles, a deep dive into words that exist only for use in a metaphor. And there's actually a word for that as well, as I learned recently, but I've forgotten what it is. Like, there's actually a term for words that only exist from archaic times that are...
Yes, I did just... It was not vestigial, but it was something like that.
Yeah.
I think what you're talking about is something like fossilized words. Or something like
that.
Yeah,
I think that's what it is.
So examples like someone is at my beck and call. Mm-hmm. We don't use the term beck anymore by itself, but we might use the phrase beck and call. And so it's interesting that some of these words still go around. So yes, anyways, we're giving you a preview of our riveting podcast, Cackles versus Cockles, subheading Champ versus Chomp, the bit controversy.
Yes.
So look forward to that for the one person out there that actually cares about grammar anymore.
Mm-hmm. So while we're talking about cockles or cackles or what it might be, that I do want to point something out because, you know, as we prepare for this time we spend in the Stardust every week recording the show, that we go through a lot of these quotes and think about what's going on. But it actually didn't occur to me until I was just reading these here for the podcast that in both of the quotes here, which I think are the most impactful paragraphs in the dog story, that the word throat is used in both of them. In the first one, it says he had to cure it, but how? His throat moved. And then in the second quote is something broke in Neville's throat. What is it about emotion that is personified by a man's throat?
Well, I think also repressed emotion, too, because as we learn, you know, the very next chapter, Neville's lost a lot of his humanity. Once we kind of see him through the eyes of another quote-unquote person, we start to see this very emotionally stunted hermit who is not used to any kind of interaction. And so I think that's the most your emotion you're going to get out of Neville is a little bit of strained throat, you know, just he doesn't even know what reflexively he's holding back anymore, but there's still that muscle tension of the holding within.
So one of the classic male traits, at least of Western masculinity, is stoicism.
Yes.
And is that what stoicism ultimately does to a man?
You know, I think men, just as women, are deeply feeling and emotional creatures. It's one of the reasons we wanted to start this podcast, because we feel like it's not often talked about enough. Even in 2021, it's still not fully okay for men to talk about their emotions. And I think, yeah, stoicism is ultimately what breaks a lot of men. Now, there are plenty of guys, as there are plenty of women, who can live fairly emotionally controlled lives and not be any worse for the wear. But I think the vast majority of us need healthy outlets for our emotions. And certainly with men in particular, when those healthy outlets are not exercised, men tend to go down more violent, more aggressive, more extreme roads, I think, often than women might.
I agree with that. But I think my point is that it seems more culturally acceptable for a man to become this somewhat unfeeling, strongly motivated, but just completely, as you say, devoid of humanity at some point, that it just seems like it's somehow culturally acceptable. Oh yeah, that's a man who is in that state. I can see how he got there.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that, you know, one of the interesting translations of that I have seen is in the workplace. Prior to becoming a full-time author, I was just a normal, regular executive at a company. And I think the American workforce, because for so long it was dominated by males and male leadership, has kind of taken on a lot of those masculine attributes of stoicism, of not showing your emotion. And I feel like there's a lot of women leaders who have felt, at least especially coming out of the previous generation, have felt like they can't show emotion because that is a sign of weakness. And one of the things that I was really fascinated to see was, you know, I worked at the time, I was the vice president at a children's charity. And certainly there's a lot of emotional things that happen around children's charities. And the few times I let emotion get the better of me in a meeting, if it was talking about a sick kid or if it was talking about something really important to the future of the charity, and my emotion showed, the general consensus or the general vibe I got in the room was how brave of Zach, you know, how brave it is for a man to show his emotion. But the minute a woman did that, which is still a very natural thing. We're talking about sick and dying children here. The minute a woman did that, it very much seemed like the room, men and women, kind of felt like, oh, how embarrassing for her. You know, that really showed some weakness there, that she kind of let that emotion slip. And so it's this weird double standard that I think has infected both genders in terms of this masculine stoicism.
I'll dig into my own personal experience here, because one of the things that, when I had come out as gay, that I was very afraid of in the workplace was showing emotion. I wanted to, and instinctively wanted to, stick with the very masculine, very stoic personality which I had been exuding in the workplace up until that point. And that was a very scary thing for me, as I was like discovering who I was and bringing that forth into the workplace as a genuine person who was going to be more emotional and more connected with my actual feelings. Like, that was super scary. I didn't want to be painted as this overly emotional gay man, which I wasn't. I still and I'm not.
There's no danger of that. Yeah.
But it's amazing. Right. Like, that is a place of safety, of being that stoic, unemotional person. And it's very scary to move away from that, because I can say from personal experience that I've been there. And as I became more in touch with who I am, that came more natural. And yet I felt a pull not to expose that in the workplace. No judgment about anyone around me. This was an internal struggle.
Let me ask you a question then. I think even as a straight man, I'm aware of this prejudice around both emotion being a quote unquote feminine trait, and at least conservative society's belief that gay men are more effeminate or less manly than. Do you think as a gay man coming out later in life, there was added pressure on you to embrace that more masculine stoicism, to kind of eschew emotion for the sake of the identity that you were trying to build?
I'm going to answer yes, but I'm going to say that a lot of that was my own personal reservation in being free enough in order to express myself for who I am. Like, that's a very tricky thing to navigate because it's uncomfortable. Like, imagine doing something that you've perhaps actively avoided or told yourself wasn't appropriate before. Mm-hmm. Like, now as you're discovering your own identity again later in life, like, it's really tricky to say what of these values. And yes, you know, it's easy to cling on to the masculine value of stoicism and emotionless communication. So that was something which is easy to retreat into. Some men are able to do it much more easily and to make that transition, which is fantastic. It's something personally that I struggled with.
Yeah, and it's so interestingly, obviously, not tied to sexuality at all. You know, we're emotional creatures, no matter how we identify, no matter what gender we are. I was bullied brutally for most of my youth because I was such an emotional kid, and men aren't supposed to be emotional. And I was certainly called every gay slur in the book because other boys, you know, whether they were taught by their fathers or by their community that men shouldn't behave that way, saw me acting tenderly, saw me openly crying, saw me, you know, getting my anger raised much more easily and viewed that as a feminine trait and wanted to emasculate me in any way possible. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting how much that still pervades society. You know, we've got Robert Neville here, who I think he's about 36 in the novel, if I'm not mistaken. So he would have been of the greatest generation. You know, 10 years earlier, he would have been fighting in World War II, theoretically. So certainly the only tool sets he has to fall back on when there are no women around to soften him, when there are no men around to give him clearance to feel the way he wants to feel, is to fall back on that tool set that he was taught more than likely as a child, that men don't show emotion. It's a weakness, and it only leads to a lack of strength, a lack of character, however that would have been framed at the time. And so I think it's interesting that we see Neville has kind of retreated back just to what he knows, and much to his own detriment. And it's this dog that kind of cracks that shell just enough to ironically cause him to make some weak decisions in the preceding chapters.
What you say makes me think that a lot of what we're talking about here is authenticity.
Yeah.
That I'm personally speaking from experience around coming out, which is an experience that isn't just about expressing one's sexual orientation. It's about having a lot of things in your life questioned and trying to figure out who the genuine person is. It's just a great motivator in order to go do those things. And yes, like, a big part of that was discovering, I'm actually a much more emotional person than I let myself be on a normal basis. And so that's sort of the door that's opened here. And I think in your case, what you're talking about is, you know, in kudos to you for being authentic and being yourself, even though it was to the detriment of being bullied. Like, that's a powerful thing that you're able to do that and to understand that part of yourself.
Well, I thank you for that. I think, you know, it's always kind of in one of those things that's in the eye of the beholder, because one of the things that I've always not envied, but certainly been a little bit jealous of with you is that you are just naturally closeted or openly so, or openly gay. You keep your emotions closer to the chest. You know, you are a deeply emotional man. You have just as strong feelings as anybody else, but I've always felt like you're more in control of your emotions than I am. And so I would like to take credit for choosing to embrace my emotions, but I just don't think I had a choice. I mean, I'm Irish after all, and there's a reason the Irish have the reputation they do. So I think I was just kind of unable to escape it, and I had to find peace with that. I think it's interesting to me that as a person who, at least on the surface, seems much more in control of his emotions, that's something that you struggled with too.
So why don't we agree to be envious of each other?
It always works. It always works for a good friendship.
Perfect. So let's spend a few minutes here talking about Ruth.
Yeah, so I mean, Neville, shortly after this dog leaves his life, finds a woman who he had been so desperately searching for just out in the middle of a field in a white virginal dress, just walking in broad daylight, seemingly unharmed by the plague and apocalypse around her.
And he doesn't question or doubt any aspect of her story?
He does, but I think he lets himself believe, he wants to believe her so much that even though his cackles are raised, I do think that he is, at the end of the day, so desperate not even for sex at this point. He makes that clear. It's just companionship. It's just, I mean, hearing her say his name almost breaks him.
Mm-hmm.
Because he hasn't had that kind of human intimacy in so very long. And I think, again, another tragedy of this novel, that she might not be what she appears to be.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I did want to talk about, interestingly enough, so the second movie adaptation of I Am Legend, Omega Man, starring Charlton Heston, came out in 1971, ironically right about when this novel is supposed to take place.
Interesting.
And
is that ironic, or is that...
I don't think it was intentional.
Okay.
No. In fact, when they started making Omega Man, they had no idea that Vincent Price had already done an adaptation of it. They were completely unaware of The Last Man on Earth, this novel's first adaptation, when they made it.
That's amazing.
But one of the interesting things that I learned in kind of just researching all of this is I had seen the movie. Not a great movie. You don't need to go out of your way to see it. Richard Matheson kind of felt like it was so far removed from his novel, he didn't even give it a second thought. But one of the interesting choices they make for the character of Ruth for 1971, she's an African-American woman. And this is something apparently Charlton Heston really lobbied for. Charlton Heston was we know him now as this kind of guns rights person, which turned a lot of people off later in his life. But he was actually very forefront about civil rights and really wanted equality in Hollywood, really fought for that, and really fought for this to be a biracial love interest in 1971, which was rarely seen on screen. But just, you know, props to that movie for kind of having some non-traditional casting for 1971 and starting to chip away at those horrible institutional foundations that Hollywood has subsisted on for so long. So anyways, yeah, I think he, much like the dog, he's very patient with Ruth. He kind of courts her back to his house. Oh, no, wait. He almost caveman-like chases her down and drags her kicking and screaming into his house, which I think he's deeply ashamed of. But it's interesting just how much of his social graces are just gone and stripped from him at this point. He doesn't want to be this bad guy. He has no ill intent to harm her in any way. And in fact, keeps repeating that throughout this violent episode. But he just has nothing left of humanity in him to really kind of give her what she would need to reassure her in those moments.
So the whole story of how she comes back to his place, and I mean, it's troubling and it's just very strange in my mind. The dynamic there didn't really resonate with me, but at the end of the day, like, here's another person.
Yeah.
And he is immediately distrustful. I gotta believe that anyone in that state is just nothing but paranoid.
Yeah.
You have to be. It's how you survive. So
you can't trust anyone, yeah.
So even if the most perfect thing without any potential risk associated with it shows up, you're still going to read something into it which is nefarious. So it doesn't surprise me.
Even if it's a redhead with a tan, which should have been his first giveaway.
There's a number of troubling things here. But it does lead well into the denouement. Well, I'm not even call it the denouement. Let's just call it the ending of the story, because it doesn't end the way that I was expecting it to.
No.
Like, the pacing of this book, maybe this is a good last thing to talk about for today, but the pacing of this book is very strange. That, like, let's take the dog thing, for instance. The dog story is like two chapters, and they're immediately adjacent to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, literally, adjacent to each other, and there is no dog story outside of those chapters. That, to me, is fascinating. Like, most writers would be like, I'm going to weave in the B story into this thing, and I'm going to have it in the background of him having this thing, taking care of this dog. No, it is compressed into that section, just like the whole thing with Ruth is compressed into the back end of this book. And the first part of the book is sort of this alcoholic, rage-filled discussion of what it's like in order to live in this time period during the vampire invasion or sickness. So it doesn't feel organic. It feels like it's really chopped up into these very intentional acts, if you want to call them that, which for me is one of the more off-putting things of this book from a literary perspective.
Oh, interesting. I appreciate the brevity of this story. I think this is something where, to demonstrate the passage of time, you could probably add another 100, 150 pages to this to make it a full-blown novel. I appreciate what he is able to do and the time that he's able to do it. I think what you're referring to is very clearly really what Matheson wants to be writing about, which is a reinterpretation of the vampire myth. and far less interested in how it all shapes up in the end. Because, yeah, the ending is, of course, very rushed. There's a lot of really awesome ideas that he throws at us right there at the end that are food for thought and we'll certainly dive into in the next episode. But, yeah, of course, the ending is extremely rushed because I think for him, he had said all he needed to say about, you know, this particular folklore reinterpretation.
That seems like a great place to wrap things up here for today.
Real quick, just going to throw this at you. Best fictional dog of all time.
Ooh, tough one. I'm going to think about that. I think I'm going to leave it as a tease for our next episode. That's going to require some... Yeah, this is the closest thing that Literary Guys gets to a cliffhanger, but I want to give that some serious thought, and I'll have a week to do it.
So catch up with us next week when we talk about the best fictional dog of all time and the ending to Richard Matheson's I Am Legend. This has been Literary Guys. You can follow us on social media.
In fact, this week we're moving our social media discussion over to Instagram, where you can follow us at Literary Guys, spelled the same as in our podcast name.
Be a part of the discussion. Let us know your favorite literary dog. We'll see you all next week. From the Stardust Lounge, this has been author Zachary Kellyan.
And Dr. Gordon McCallan, signing off.